Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. I think that I'm a conscious being. I'm a subject of experience. If you were to squeeze my hand or stick a knife in it, it would feel like something for me when you did that. By contrast, if you stick a knife in the dirt beneath your feet, it's not like anything for the ground to have a knife stuck in it. Something I've noticed about my mind, I'm in a better position to know what's going on within my point of view than anybody else. I have privileged access. Pain, for example, is a mental event, and the subject is in a better place to know about that mental event than anybody else. They know about it with greater certainty than anybody else. As Colin McGinn put it, if consciousness is a stream, it is an invisible stream. Of course, I'm not just a mind. I'm also a physical body, which is closely conjoined with my mind. I'm an embodied conscious person. Thanks to the physical world, other minds, such as yourself, can have a pretty good idea of what's going on in my mind. Sometimes other people notice, attend to, physical indicators of my feelings and experiences before I attend to my feelings and experiences themselves, meaning they know what I'm feeling even before I'm fully aware that I'm having those feelings. Even so, they have to work from indicators of my feelings, not the feelings themselves. Certain physical behavior is reliably correlated with certain experiences, so this is actually pretty easy for an attentive observer. Now, even just in setting up what we're going to be talking about, I've already said a couple things that might bother physicalists, the philosophers who think consciousness is nothing over and above the physical material of the brain. But there are many strains of physicalism, and some of the stranger forms would disagree with the less contentious things I said. Like that I have privileged access to my own mind, that I'm in a better place to know about my experiences than anyone else. Qualitative or phenomenal properties are typically understood as private, meaning they are not publicly observable like ordinary physical properties. Some physicalists think phenomenal consciousness is an illusion, and privacy is one of those illusory aspects of the mind that they think we should reject. For example, in Quine and Qualia, Daniel Dennett identifies privacy as one of the attributes of this illusory phenomenal consciousness. Today we won't be focusing on the negative case against privacy, but rather on building a positive case for it, so I won't be examining in detail the negative arguments against privacy, privileged access, invisibility, etc., at least not today. Illusionists and other privacy skeptics have rejected this aspect of the mind, so in defending privacy, I'm arguing against illusionism. Sort of like how some people have argued against Russellian panpsychism by arguing that there is no intrinsic nature to the physical, which cuts at the heart of the Russellian picture of the world. Insofar as the rejection of privacy is a part of illusionism, I'm arguing against illusionism today. It's not just about illusionism, though. There are other privacy skeptics out there, first of all. But beyond that, I just happen to have a minor fixation on the privacy of experience. As Jafir Ahmed put it, mental privacy is at once the most elusive and the most obvious thesis in modern philosophy of mind. It's elusive because a characterization of it is difficult to formulate, and it's obvious because the idea that each of us knows their minds in a special way, which is not available to others, has significant intuitive appeal. End quote. Even though I think the privacy of consciousness is pretty unobjectionable, explaining privacy is not at all trivial. I've attached a link to Colin McGinn exploring the issue of trying to explain the privacy of the mental and how it factors into his Mysterian approach. I don't hear about privacy as much as I would like to. As Ahmed points out, much of the debate on privacy has been subsumed by the knowledge argument controversy. But this issue has been a part of the philosophical landscape, quote, at least since the work of Descartes in the 17th century. It was Descartes who first developed the idea of the mind as a private space containing thoughts, feelings and sensations which the person who has the mind cannot doubt. This conception of the mind has continued to form the background against which contemporary debates in the philosophy of mind have taken place in the last century. However, modern philosophers have eschewed comprehensive engagement with this fundamental idea in the philosophy of mind, in favor of debates which are nevertheless tied to it. The only major philosopher who's written a complete treatment of the subject has been A.J. Ayer in 1964. His argument has been that the mind is indeed private, and that the Cartesian picture of it is mostly correct. End quote. But why does anyone have a bone to pick with privacy? Well, some philosophers think qualia are not even possibly real. They think there's no such thing as private experience, maybe because such a thing would be incoherent, or contentless, just doesn't mean anything, or otherwise the product of confusion. Others don't go that far, they just think we have no good reason to believe in private consciousness. They try to undercut our justification for believing in qualia, although they may concede there's nothing fundamentally confused about the concept. And I would add that private experience doesn't have an obvious place in the physical world. Publicly unobservable in principle, you know, it doesn't make for a comfortable fit. It's not really amenable to scientific inquiry. So if you're a very conservative naturalist, or extremely confident that physicalism is true, or that science will provide us the complete metaphysical story of reality, and there's no easy way to shoehorn private experience into the world, as described purely by physical science, then you might be tempted to Morian shift it out of existence, or begin to question private experience on conceptual or epistemic grounds, like I mentioned. So those who reject privacy are going to be in the hot seat today. At least to my mind, the rejection of privacy is one of the weirder aspects of illusionism, as well as quietism, type A physicalism, whoever claims there's no private aspect to conscious experience. I think the conscious mind is not publicly observable like the brain is publicly observable. The fact that something about consciousness is private is not a philosopher's fiction or some technical bit of jargon that doesn't have any relevance outside philosophy of mind. Privacy creeps into other areas of philosophy, as well as science, medicine, and ordinary life. And that's mainly what the last section is about. Even if you think eliminating privacy is a live option, it's not an option to remove it with surgical precision, avoiding any further repercussions. So I want to provide a few arguments to that effect, rather than taking it as a basic datum. For better or worse, a lot of debates over radical forms of physicalism, or what have you, often come down to issues in fundamental epistemology. Whether or not I succeed, I don't know. Maybe there really isn't enough common ground between qualia realists and anti-realists to make arguments like these. But I'll try anyway, and, you know, we'll see. Okay, so what is privacy? I've often found that those who reject the privacy of consciousness will also, at times, claim to not know what privacy means. And to be fair, maybe they don't. People use concepts in different ways. Maybe they're not trying to be difficult, they just really don't know what it means. So I'm going to provide a few lengthy passages from philosophers who have all different kinds of views on privacy just to ensure that everyone is on the same page. And if you listened to my epistemology series from a while back, you'll know that I think understanding a word is not usually a matter of knowing a definition. I think definitions are overrated and unnecessary in understanding a concept. It's better to give examples if you want someone to understand a term. Giving a definition is usually not the shortest pathway there. So I'm relying on these lengthy passages so you can see how the concept is used and how it fits into the broader conceptual web. If you already know what privacy is, you can skip this section. In fact, if you just want the arguments for privacy in concentrated form, then I would just skip to the final two sections, summing up the epistemic asymmetry argument and inference to the best explanation. Okay, but for the rest of you who are on a journey with me, you know, you're here for the ride, for the long, leisurely drive through the country. So here's qualia quietist Pete Mandick setting up a view that he does not agree with. Quote, "One of the central ideas that behaviorists rebel against, an idea with close associations with Descartes and his dualism, is the idea of the privacy of the mental. The idea of privacy is that you can only have knowledge of your own mind. You can make an educated guess about other minds, but you can only know, or only know with certainty, your own mind. From a Cartesian point of view, sensations are known only privately. Others can observe your behaviors, but only you can experience your sensations. From the point of view of someone on the outside, your sensations might be very different or altogether missing." So I would disagree with that bit about knowledge. I don't think privacy implies that you can only have knowledge of your own mind. If it did, that would almost be a sufficient argument against privacy. If you could not know that other minds exist, if you accept the privacy thesis, you know, that would be a sufficient reason to reject privacy. So you can know about other minds, but the point about certainty is a fairly common one. If anything is certain, the existence of my own mind is certain. Not so with other minds. I can easily doubt the existence of other minds, since there's some kind of epistemic asymmetry between the mental states of others and my own mental states, a fact that is best explained by privacy. So Hedda Hassel-Merck explains further, quote, "To say that one's conscious states are private does not mean that nobody else can know anything about them. It rather means that nobody else can know about them in the same direct way. That is, my own conscious states appear directly to me, whereas the conscious states of other people we infer or perceive indirectly through their behavior, verbal reports, facial expressions, and so on. Because of this direct access, many philosophers also hold that our own consciousness can be known with absolute certainty. Descartes famously claimed that we have indubitable knowledge of our own consciousness and thereby our own existence. Cogito ergo sum." End quote. So in crudely plain language, I cannot look at your experiences, not in the way that I can observe your body language, the contortions of your face, and even your neurological events. I'm not sure why anyone would deny that or claim to not understand what is meant by that. For many people, this is an unrevisable datum that simply needs to be accounted for. Because they're my experiences, I'm in a different position with respect to them than you are or ever could be. I can't pull out a qualia microscope and zoom into your brain tissue and eventually see your thoughts and feelings and experiences. I can observe electrochemical brain activity. In principle, I could observe neurons and even the atoms that compose them and all the physical goings-on in your brain. And with enough progress in neuroscience, I could work out, in a sort of inferential way, what you're feeling. But this hypothetical futuristic technology, which you could see a terrifying example of in Avatar 2, will never put me in the same direct, immediate relation to your first-person experiences that you stand in. I like how Richard Swinburne put it, quote, "Whatever ways others have of finding out whether I am seeing the tree outside my window, or have a thought that today is Thursday, or am intending to shut the door, I could also use. Like others, I could study my behavior by watching a film of it, or inspect my brain via some instrument. But I have an additional way of finding out whether I am seeing the tree or having the thought that today is Thursday or am intending to shut the door, by actually having the experience of seeing the tree or having the thought or intention. And no one else could have that way of knowing about these events. A mental event would not be my mental event unless I could become aware of it by experiencing it. Someone else can have a pain of the same intensity and duration at the same time I do, but there would be two different pains, her pain and my pain. By contrast, what makes it the case that inanimate objects as well as humans and higher animals have physical events is that they are public events. What makes an event a physical event is that it is an event to which no one substance can have privileged access by experiencing it. Any physical event is necessarily equally accessible to any human with the right training. It is for this reason that all the events which happen in the inanimate world, and also all the events in our bodies, are physical events. A brain event, a certain neuron firing at a certain time, is a physical event. Although it may cause someone to have a sensation, the brain event is not itself an event to which anyone has the unique access of the kind that they have to their sensations. End quote. And here's another passage from Hedda Hassel-Merck, this one from her paper on open individualism. "Consciousness should here be understood as phenomenal consciousness, in other words, there being something that it's like to be that entity, for that entity, it could be added. It should also be understood as unified consciousness. An entity has unified consciousness if its consciousness is associated with a single point of view, from which different individual qualities or contents, such as colors, sounds, emotions, and thoughts, in the case of typical human consciousness, are experienced together, and from outside of which they cannot be directly experienced. In other words, unified consciousness has a border around it that not only internally unifies all the experiences of its subject, but also separates and makes them inaccessible to any other subjects, securing what is known as the privacy of consciousness." End quote. And finally, here's Wittgenstein inveighing against privacy. "Can't I imagine that the people around me are automata, lack consciousness, even though they behave in the same way as usual? If I imagine it now, alone in my room, I see people with fixed looks as in a trance going about their business. The idea is perhaps a little uncanny, but just try to hang on to this idea in the midst of your ordinary intercourse with others in the street, say. Say to yourself, for example, the children over there are mere automata. All their liveliness is mere automatism. And you'll either find these words becoming quite empty, or you'll produce in yourself some kind of uncanny feeling or something of the sort. End quote. So I could keep going, but if you still don't get the gist of it, I really don't know what to tell you. I just read a number of philosophers with wildly disparate views who were all talking about the same thing and taking different positions on it and factoring it into their broader arguments. So if you claim to not know what any of these people are talking about in the first place, and I know some of you will, then I'm sorry, but without like a further explanation, I'm led to think that you are either incompetent or in the grips of some theory that's causing you to say very strange and implausible things. So let's return to that scenario raised by Wittgenstein a moment ago. Anyone who's been interested in philosophy for 10 seconds has probably come across the problem of other minds in various forms. So you know about your own mind quite directly, but you don't know about the minds of others in the same way. It seems like you only have access to their physical states and behavior. So how do you know that other people are really conscious like you? You know, maybe they're not. Of course, I don't bring this up because there's a nail-biting question over whether other people have minds, or whether we know about other minds. They do, and we do. But there's still a puzzle to mess around with here. This is from the SCP entry on other minds. Quote, philosophers thus find themselves saddled with the question, how do I know that others have minds? One can put the emphasis on the word know and raise a skeptical question, parallel to the one Descartes raised in connection with our knowledge of the external world. Or one can put the emphasis on the word how and question the source of our knowledge, given that I'm not in a position to have direct knowledge of the mind of another. This is from the same entry. Some see the problem as arising from reflection on an apparent asymmetry in the way I know about my own mind and another's mind. In my own case, at least most of the time, I know what I think and feel directly, without inference from any evidence. End quote. So there are a few different directions you could go in discussing the epistemic problem of other minds, and here I'm not trying to answer the problem or even explore it further. I'm just setting it up to make the point that there is an apparent problem to be contemplated here. Why is there a problem, to begin with? I think the problem of other minds is generated by an epistemic asymmetry between one's own mind and the minds of others, an asymmetry that poses a difficulty for the anti-privacy view. In his contribution to Illusionism as a Theory of Consciousness, edited by Keith Frankish, George Ray made the following comment, quote, I seriously find it pretty much as difficult to doubt the consciousness of other people and many higher animals as I do my own. So I found that pretty striking since it's contrary to my views, and probably most people's views. No one feels compelled to write, yeah, I find it much easier to doubt the existence of my dog's mind than my own mind. That's all I wanted to say. It's just too obvious to be worth writing for its own sake. Apparently, Ray feels differently. To him, they are equally difficult to doubt. So is this just an abnormal psychological fact about one person? Maybe, but I find it more likely that anyone who says this is in the grips of a theory that leads them to say it. For me, it's easier to doubt the minds of animals than it is to doubt my own consciousness. I think that's probably true for most people, but I don't intend that in a merely descriptive sense. There's an implicit evaluation here. You are rational in the ordering of skepticism. You are justified in accepting an asymmetry between your mind and other minds. So I say you're justified. What do I mean by a justified belief? This is from Michael Humer in Understanding Knowledge. A justified belief is one that is reasonable, one that makes sense to hold, one that is likely to be true given the believer's evidence. So, however hard it may be to doubt the minds of cats, it's easier to doubt their consciousness than yours. And you're justified in accepting this asymmetry. I would think someone was being irrational if they said that belief in the existence of their own mind and the minds of others were on equal footing. I mean, when I really think about that, it is just not my honest assessment of the evidence that I have equal justification for believing in my own mind and the minds of others. So I would put it to you, is that your assessment of the evidence? Is it really your assessment of the evidence that there's no difference between these things epistemically? I mean, it's definitely not mine, but illusionism, or any anti-privacy view, I think commits you to this epistemic symmetry. So imagine an asymmetry in a totally different case. Imagine someone was very skeptical about the existence of guitars, but Cartesianly certain about the existence of ukuleles. That was just an odd psychological fact about this person. You would think they were being irrational. Or imagine someone who's not roughly equally confident about the existence of their right hand and their left hand. They're very, very certain, extremely confident about the existence of their right hand. But their left hand? I mean, be serious. Very doubtful. We would think that person was being irrational. If they endorsed right-hand, left-hand asymmetry, we would try to point it out to them that they were being unreasonable, that they have roughly equal justification for belief in their right hand and their left hand. And if they're rational, they should think, oh man, you're right, why do I think that? What an odd psychological fact about me. So how does that compare to the case of your mind versus other minds? Do you think it's irrational to endorse the asymmetry? Because when I turn my attention to the evidence, to the reasons I have to believe in your mind, they're really good. I have great reason to think that other minds exist. But then I think about my own mind, and it seems as though I have something else to support my own mind. I don't think I'm being irrational when I endorse the asymmetry between my mind and other minds. The level of justification is not the same. Something that leads me to think that is that all the evidence that I have for your mind, I can also have for my mind. I could observe all my behavior in a mirror or on a screen. I could observe my brain activity with scientific instruments. Everything that I have for you, I can also have for me. So far, we'd be on equal footing. But then there's something else that I seem to have for me that I just don't have for you. It's the exact opposite of the right-hand, left-hand case, where it seems like the evidence I have for my left hand is exactly the same as the evidence I have for my right hand. And I think to myself, well, hang on, it must be private then, whatever that something else is that I have for me that I don't have for you. Because if it weren't private, I could have it for you. I could appeal to it to support the existence of your mind, not just my own. So at this point, I'm thinking, why would I endorse the anti-privacy view? Wouldn't that lead me to George Ray's position? When I draw my attention to the evidence, wouldn't that lead me to thinking, oh, I actually have equal reason for believing in other minds in my own mind, roughly equal, just like I have roughly equal justification for believing in my right hand and my left hand. If there is no private aspect to consciousness, then it seems as though my mind and other minds should be on equal footing. But I would submit that is not the case. So the anti-privacy view must be wrong. I think at this point it might be worth flagging something. Not all illusionists, or whoever might be claiming to deny the privacy of consciousness, believe the same thing. They do not all have the exact same opinion about privacy, or really much else. So some of them could rightly say, this doesn't threaten my version of anti-privacy. I mean something much more modest. We at least have privacy in this sense. Okay, well, great. I was not under the impression that I was arguing against each and every person who has ever made noises against privacy. I do think I'm coming into contact with what some anti-privacy folks think. I have a minor fixation on the privacy of experience because A, I think it's just an interesting feature of consciousness, and B, because I think it has anti-physicalist implications. Privacy as I'm using the term. That's why I'm going about things in this way, even though, for some people, this probably just feels like overkill. And we're not even done yet. I'm going to flesh out this argument a bit more, and then I'm going to offer several other arguments. I want to establish a baseline. We at least have this. So if you think you have some argument to the contrary, then it must be wrong. And remember, I'm trying to establish some common ground, some unobjectionable shared premises. That's how arguments are supposed to proceed. You start with things that you both agree with and work from there. As for those who hold to a more modest form of privacy, I would invite you to reflect upon whether your form of privacy is private enough. Are your anti-privacy views really consistent with everything that we've discussed so far? I'm worried about a kind of Mott and Bailey where someone will defend a very unobjectionable form of anti-privacy. Oh, I'm just saying that you can know the minds of others. I'm just saying that epistemically, mental state attribution is not always inferential. Sometimes it's non-inferential. And then in other settings, saying something that sounds a lot edgier and a lot closer to the denial that there is really any difference between the perception of the body and the quote-unquote perception of the mind. As Colin McGinn put it, quote, "Privacy here is best understood perceptually. States of mind are not perceptible by means of the senses. It is not denied that they may be subjects of legitimate inference or even of interpretive seeing, but they're not objects of perception in the way the body is. I can see your facial features in a way that I can't see your thoughts or feelings or sensations." I should say a word about those who believe that the mind is perceptible, as when we see a man's suffering in his face. I don't accept that type of description at face value. Face value. Even if I did, it would not affect the point of this paper, since it would be agreed that other minds are not perceivable except by virtue of expressive behavior. No one supposes that you can see the mind of another when there's no behavior to go on, say when the person is asleep and dreaming. The question would then be what explains this fact. End quote. I just had to add that because there are some people who will say you can perceive the minds of others. All I'm saying is there's a line you can't cross. States of mind are not objects of perception in the way the body is. As Mason Westfall put it, if perceptualism were true, why would people think a distinctive skeptical problem about mental state attribution existed at all? If the perceptualist's phenomenological descriptions are taken at face value, we would expect skepticism about other minds to be just as gripping as skepticism about dogs or cups. After all, according to the perceptualist, both are perceptually presented. But we don't feel gripped by skepticism about dogs in the same way. Perceptualists are not well positioned to explain why not. As Westfall says elsewhere in the paper, those of us intuitively inclined towards a perceptual view are attending to the directness of many mental state attributions. Notice in particular how commonly perceptualists motivate their view by emphasizing the non-inferential character of many mental state attributions, while those of us inclined towards an inferential view are attending to invisibility, the fact that others' mental states are not presented in visual experiences. The possibility of immediately justified beliefs that outstrip what is perceptually presented is often overlooked, so the intuitions are taken to clash, and philosophers have felt forced to choose between them. But once we revise our views about the relationship between perceptual presentation and perceptual judgment, we can explain what is right about both perceptualism and inferentialism, although neither is complete. End quote. And accordingly, this paper from Westfall is titled, "Other Minds Are Neither Seen Nor Inferred." Although it may be the case that one man's quote-unquote perceptual judgment is another man's unconscious inference, I'm not sure how to resolve that. And another point I would want to add, in defense of the more standard inferential view, is a distinction between two types of knowledge. I think we should distinguish between the kind of spontaneous judgments that we form in the real world, you know, psychologically, how do we come to form belief in other minds, and the question of more reflective knowledge. Surely my cat has knowledge of other minds. I'm assuming my cat is not making inferences. Maybe unconscious inferences, but I am fairly certain that my cat is not reasoning through the problem of other minds. In any case, it's not at all an implausible view that mental state attribution is often non-inferential. And further, it would be very strange to say that my cat does not have knowledge of other minds because she can't read Michael Humer's paper about why inference to the best explanation is our best bet in securing our high degree of confidence in the knowledge of other minds. But maybe that kind of knowledge that my cat has of other minds should be distinguished from the more reflective knowledge that philosophers are usually after. I think maybe sometimes we equivocate on the term knowledge. So I talked about this in the epistemology series, specifically in the section about why I'm an internalist rather than an externalist. And without going into all that, I'll just say, I think the new evil demon argument pretty conclusively shows that internalism is true. But on the other hand, I can see why cases involving animals or small children could motivate externalism, whereby we don't need any kind of internal justification to secure knowledge. And as Humer talked about in Understanding Knowledge, which the series was based on, the answer might be to distinguish between two types of knowledge. Quote, animal knowledge requires reliability, but does not require internal justification or knowledge of one's own reliability. The internalist kind of knowledge, sometimes called reflective knowledge, is a higher grade of knowledge that requires one to be able to justify one's belief on reflection. This is the sort of knowledge that philosophers have traditionally sought after. End quote. On the one hand, we have a kind of animal knowledge, but then on the other hand, there's reflective knowledge. I don't think animals need to worry about Gettier cases. I think they can have knowledge. But I do think that there is a type of knowledge that clearly is threatened by Gettier cases. So maybe the best position is to say we have two concepts of knowledge here. One is a roughly externalist conception of knowledge that can help explain how animals and small children have knowledge despite being unable to supply justification for their beliefs. And then there's reflective knowledge, the higher grade of knowledge that we would be worried about losing in Gettier cases, for example. So if you want to hear more about that, then check out the video, Four Things I Learned About Epistemology. But for our purposes, I'm just going to leave it there. I bring that up because I think it might be able to shed light on this dispute between inferentialists about other minds and non-inferentialists. Maybe we should all be inferentialists about reflective knowledge of other minds. But maybe when it comes to animal knowledge, which I think closely parallels the kind of ordinary knowledge that we have when we're not reflecting on things, the kind of spontaneous psychological judgments that we form in the real world, then maybe there's more to be said for non-inferential justification. Even though, in the end, I'm not on board at all with someone who would even imply that other minds are perceptually presented to us. Again, that's just a hard line. This kind of middle category of perceptual judgment contrasted with perceptual presentation, well, as long as that's something that animals and small children can do, then I think it can help with this concept of knowledge, even though I'm more inclined to the inferentialist answer when it comes to reflective knowledge. So that's why I bring up that distinction. Now, if you remember, we only went down this path because I was worried that some people who are tempted to say crazy-sounding things about rejecting privacy might then just fall back on something like what I was just describing. Oh, all I'm saying is that sometimes our judgments about other minds are non-inferential. That is not the same thing as rejecting privacy. So, returning to that argument from earlier, I think it's easier to doubt the minds of others than it is to doubt one's own mind. There is an epistemic asymmetry between one's own mind and the minds of others, and this is best explained by the privacy of consciousness. If we were to reject privacy, even some of the more modest iterations, it would lead to epistemic symmetry between one's own mind and the minds of others. That should be avoided. That result is not acceptable. And I'm hoping that that's enough common ground. It seems like when it comes to my own case, there is something I have to support the existence of, you know, my own mind that I don't have to support the existence of yours. If that is not obvious, if that's not common ground between us, well, I tried my best to locate some common ground, but apparently I'm to believe that I have equal justification for the belief in your mind and belief in the existence of my own mind. So let's follow that thread. If the anti-privacy view is correct, then there's nothing I have for my mind that I don't also have for yours. So I have equal justification for both. You'd think that because there's a problem of other minds in the first place that this isn't the case, no? Is everyone who talks about the problem of other minds just fundamentally confused? Because it seems as though there's an asymmetry there. Of course, I do know that you're conscious. You also know that you're conscious. But we acquired that knowledge differently, right? The way that you know you're conscious is not the same exact way that I know you're conscious. There must be some difference. I can't help but notice that I have never, in any context, inferred that I'm conscious from my physical behavior, but I have done this with other minds. And I'm not saying that's how we know about other minds in general, I'm just saying I've made inferences like this in my life before. And even though I can observe behavior, and even the activity of the brain, I can still wonder whether this person is conscious like me. Can I wonder whether I'm conscious? Even if I could wonder whether I'm conscious, would those doubts really be on a par with doubts about other minds? Like, think about what I just said. I wonder whether this random guy over here is conscious, versus I wonder whether I am conscious. If you honestly say, yes, these are epistemically equal, on a par, makes perfect sense. God bless, have fun, go buck wild. I guess this really does come down to foundational epistemology. I could not say that my honest judgment of the evidence is that I have equal justification for belief in my mind and the minds of others. I have a high degree of justification for both, but they're not on equal footing. Okay, so instead of summing up this argument now, we're going to take a break from this line of reasoning, and then we're going to come back to it after this next section. So you have the raw materials, but I think we should take a breath. So we're going to let all that bake in the oven for a minute, and then we'll peek our heads in there after we talk about the connection with zombies first, and then we'll sum up the asymmetry argument, and then we're going to run through a wide-ranging final section on coma patients and surgery and newborns, and ultimately, why inference to the best explanation supports privacy. That's the plan. And I'll just add at this point, if I'm misunderstanding your rejection of privacy, then please treat this as an opportunity to clarify what you're talking about. Because I really think anyone can see that there's some private aspect to experience. I mean, like, it's so obvious that I'm genuinely confused by what the skeptics are saying here. And when I try to explain the rejection of privacy to the blessedly uninitiated in philosophy of mind, they often feel like it's a trick question. Like, it's hard to probe what they actually think about this because it sounds like I'm asking them if they think the sky is blue or something. And I don't think that the watered-down versions of privacy that I've seen tossed around sometimes could really deliver this. Like, if you read Quining Qualia, Dennett talks about this version of privacy that's compatible with his views. So our experiences can be private in the sense that we each have idiosyncratic reactions to stimuli. He also uses the word proprietary. So we can all react or have the capacity to react to the same stimulus in unique ways. And I guess that's all the mental privacy we get. I mean, to me, that doesn't even come close to what I'm talking about when I'm talking about privacy. And that just can't deliver what I'm putting a spotlight on with respect to justification. That is not the only argument I'll be presenting. Like I said, the final section, I think, in certain ways, is the most interesting. But I think we ought to move on to the connection with the zombies. So in the zombie argument episode, if you remember, the problem of other minds came up briefly, and I'm including a section from that episode here as a sort of interlude, because what we've been talking about today, I think, lends support to the ideal conceivability of zombies. At face value, it's much easier to imagine a zombie world once you recognize the privacy of experience. But on a deeper level, I also think it's easier to see how publicly observable, perceptually presented physical properties can come apart from private, subjective properties. There's at least a conceptual dualism here. That's all you really need to secure the ideal conceivability of bodies without minds. So as you've heard, I think there's an intimate connection between the problem of other minds and the privacy of consciousness. That's not universally agreed upon in philosophy, although it's a very common view. You heard it referenced earlier in the SCP entry on the problem of other minds. If there were no private aspect to consciousness at all, then it's unclear why there would be a problem of other minds in the first place, since minds would be just as visible as bodies. Or at least, it's not clear why there would be a unique skeptical problem when it comes to other minds. If minds are just another perceptually presented feature of the world, then skepticism about other minds would be folded into external world skepticism more broadly. So skepticism about cups and skepticism about other minds would be on a par. But as Westfall pointed out, we do not find these problems equally gripping, and those who claim we can simply perceive the minds of others are not well positioned to explain why. So I do think there's a connection between the problem of other minds and privacy. Privacy is responsible for the epistemic asymmetry that generates the problem to begin with. So if there's a connection between privacy and the problem of other minds, and there's a connection between the problem of other minds and zombies, then there's a connection between privacy and zombies. And if you take a step back, this makes sense. In these kinds of scenarios, we're talking about bodies without minds. As I said in the zombie episode, here the only point is that it is not incoherent or unintelligible or otherwise conceptually confused to entertain the scenario that some percentage of the human population doesn't have a mind. I mean, it's conceivable that you're the only one. It's not plausible. It just can't be ruled out on the basis of conceptual incoherence. It is not a priori that this is false. In other words, it is conceivable. And if you're the kind of physicalist who thinks it can be ruled out on conceptual grounds, then you should pivot to epistemology and defeat this kind of radical skepticism once and for all. Good luck with that. As long as you think these kinds of scenarios are conceivable, then it's hard for me to see what your issue could be with the notion of a philosophical zombie. Put another way, if you think that zombies are not ideally conceivable, then you think it's not ideally conceivable that the flesh and blood people around you lack an inner mental life. So you're committed to the view that we can solve the problem of other minds and demonstrate that it's not even conceivable that other minds don't exist, so long as we can observe their complex behavior and brain activity. So, given the obvious fact that you can't solve the problem of other minds by pointing to physical behavior in ever-increasing fine-grained detail, I think the conceivability of zombies remains pretty unthreatened by the challenges thrown its way. And predictably, some will just bite the bullet and agree, emphatically, that we can solve the problem of other minds this way. Wow, what a spectacular advantage of the view. But this is where I would Morian shift my way back to sanity. The fact that this is an implication of the position that zombies are inconceivable is a clear liability. If your view accidentally dissolves the problem of other minds with no remainder, then your view went wrong somewhere. As Goff put it in Galileo's Error, the fact that you cannot rule out for certain the possibility that Susan is a zombie shows something interesting. What this shows is that there's no contradiction in the idea that something with the same physical nature as Susan could lack an inner subjective life. For if certain facts about Susan's body and brain were inconsistent with her being a zombie, then you could rely on this fact to prove that Susan is not a zombie. The very fact that there is a problem of other minds entails that zombies are logically possible, in the sense that there's no inconsistency or incoherence in the idea of a zombie. Contrast flying pigs and square circles. Neither of these things exist, but flying pigs have a slight advantage over square circles in that they're at least logically possible. There's no contradiction in the idea of a flying pig. What the insolubility of the problem of other minds reveals is that philosophical zombies are more like flying pigs than square circles. Nobody thinks that philosophical zombies exist any more than they think flying pigs exist. There's no contradiction in the idea of a zombie, and hence if our universe had been very different, perhaps if the laws of nature had been different, there could have been zombies roaming our planet. So, summing up the epistemic asymmetry argument, I submit that it is easier to doubt the consciousness of others than it is to doubt the existence of my own consciousness. Radical stuff, I know. Further, a subject is rational in holding that the existence of their mind is more secure than the existence of other minds, because the subject has an additional source of justification for belief in the existence of their own mind. Whatever I have to support the existence of other minds, I also have for my mind, since I can observe all my physical behavior, for example, in a mirror or on a screen or with some scientific instrument. Whatever I have for others, I can also have for myself. But it appears that I have something else to justify the belief in my mind that I do not have to justify my belief in other minds. So, I think there's an epistemic asymmetry between one's own mind and the minds of others. That's how we get a problem of other minds to begin with. Here, it's not necessary to take a hard position on what that something else is exactly, just that A, it provides a source of justification for the belief in my own mind, a source of justification that I lack when it comes to the minds of others, and B, that it's private. So why believe that the extra source of justification is private rather than publicly accessible? Because if it were not private, then you could cite it to support your belief in the minds of others. But this is precisely what we've denied by accepting the asymmetry. You have an additional source of justification for the belief in the existence of your own mind that you do not have for the belief in the existence of other minds. Where could that additional justification come from other than private consciousness? Because if it weren't private, then you would also have it for others, not just yourself, and you'd be kicked back to the position of epistemic symmetry. So this is why there's a conflict between epistemic asymmetry and the rejection of mental privacy. The privacy anti-realist is committed to symmetry. They're committed to the view that the belief in other minds and one's own mind are epistemically on a par. Whatever you have to support the existence of other minds, you also have for your own. But if there's no private aspect of consciousness, that's all you have for anyone, yourself included. So the belief in one's own mind would be on equal footing as the belief in other minds. On the other hand, if there is private consciousness, then it's clear how I could have something justifying the existence of my own mind that I wouldn't have to justify the existence of other minds. So if we're going to embrace the asymmetry, as I think we should, then we need something that's not publicly available. Fortunately, there's this thing called qualia or phenomenal consciousness that is typically taken to be private, to which the subject has privileged access. It would perfectly explain the epistemic asymmetry. So lucky us, privacy can neatly explain the asymmetry. It can explain why it seems we are rationally justified in taking the existence of our own minds to be more certain than the existence of other minds. The anti-privacy view, however, is not amenable to the asymmetry. It commits us to epistemic symmetry, the view that one has equal or roughly equal justification for believing in their own mind as they have for believing in the minds of other humans and higher animals. But I don't think it's the case that these beliefs are all on a par with one another, so I'm compelled to reject the anti-privacy view. So I'll return to George Ray's comment in his contribution to Illusionism as a Theory of Consciousness, edited by Keith Frankish. Quote, "I seriously find it pretty much as difficult to doubt the consciousness of other people as I do my own." I mean, that is where this leads. And for me, that's just too high of a cost. I cannot say that my honest judgment of the evidence is that I have equal justification for belief in my mind and the minds of others. I have a high degree of justification for belief in both, but they are not on equal footing. So this is a major reason why I think there's a private aspect to consciousness. So I'm going to go through a few more lines of evidence, a little more rapid fire. I think privacy is the best explanation of a number of facts about our minds, not just the fact that I have a greater degree of justification for the belief in my own mind than I have for the belief in the minds of other humans and higher animals. So here are a few of them. First, widespread disagreement on where consciousness exists in nature. Is it like something to be a worm, or a honeybee, a starfish? Well, it's not like we can just go check. Even informed scientists and philosophers have different views about consciousness across the biological world. We can't just go out and empirically observe whether a starfish is conscious. They may or may not be. No one really knows. Widespread disagreement on animal consciousness is best explained by the privacy of subjective experience. Next, the possibility of panpsychism. Some philosophers and scientists have argued that physical matter and consciousness are two sides of the same coin. They think experience is an intrinsic part of physical matter, regardless of what kind of larger system that matter constitutes. So panpsychists believe that you're only made of one substance, but that your physical body has an interiority to it. You're subjectively mental from inside, and physical from the outside. Panpsychists draw no arbitrary line in the natural world where this interior-exterior nature of substance is cut off. You yourself are made of protons, neutrons, electrons, and consciousness. It's all the same physical material everywhere. The fact that this may be true, and that the debate can't be settled by appeal to public observation, is best explained by the fact that consciousness is private. Really, this is just an extension of the previous point about the consciousness of lower animals. You just keep going down. So my main argument throughout this episode has been about justification, but we could also switch gears to conceivability and reframe those two previous points. It's conceivable that consciousness doesn't exist in certain physical structures to which we typically attribute consciousness, and it's conceivable that consciousness does exist in physical structures to which we do not ordinarily attribute consciousness. So it's conceivable, which, to remind you, doesn't just mean possible to imagine, but rather means conceptually possible or can't be ruled out just through reasoning about the concepts involved. So it's conceivable that 85% of dogs are conscious and 15% are not. There's nothing incoherent about that state of affairs. Alternatively, it's possible that starfish are conscious or coral reefs, physical structures that we don't ordinarily think of as being subjectively mental from the inside. So we could make one argument about the conceivability of consciousness in surprising places, and another about consciousness conceivably not existing in physical structures that we typically attribute consciousness to. Next, consider past surgical practices. So here's a somewhat disturbing fact about newborns. This is from Jonathan Birch. Quote, "In the 1980s, it was still apparently common to perform surgery on newborn babies without anesthetic on both sides of the Atlantic. This led to appalling cases and to public outcry and to campaigns to change clinical practice. People don't need convincing anymore that we should take newborn human babies seriously as sentience candidates, but the tale is a useful cautionary tale because it shows you how deep that overconfidence can run and how problematic it can be. It just underlines this point that overconfidence about sentience is everywhere and is dangerous." In Birch's book, The Edge of Sentience, he continually warns us about that kind of overconfidence about sentience. I think it would be difficult to explain how the hell this overconfidence got a foothold to begin with, without privacy. Why were doctors so confident that they weren't doing any serious harm by performing surgery on newborns without anesthetic? Couldn't they see that they were doing harm? Well, apparently not. Although they were never in the dark about the physical responses of the newborns. And I think the privacy skeptic might say, well, the advocates also had nothing to go off of but the physical responses of the newborns. And they were so confident that they were in pain because they were crying and for whatever other reasons you think other people have minds. And that's true. But to repeat my point, without privacy, how did this overconfidence from doctors get a foothold to begin with? Why did they not only believe, but were confident that they weren't doing any serious harm by performing surgery on newborns in the way that they were? Without privacy, how is it even possible that anyone ever thought that they weren't doing any harm? Privacy is obviously the best explanation there. The same goes for coma patients. Birch notes multiple cases of patients who were unresponsive after a brain injury, and doctors were confident that they couldn't hear anything or feel anything, that is, until the patients woke up and accurately reported what they'd been hearing. The reality of mental privacy, once again, is the best explanation of how anyone ever ended up in a nightmarish situation like that. And because of cases like these, it's far more common to talk to coma patients, to explain what's happening to these unresponsive patients so there's less of a risk of worsening their experience by shuttling them from surgery to surgery without them having any clue what's happening to them. So that brings me to the next point, self-report in neuroscience. Self-report has played a crucial role in the science of understanding what's going on in the mind. Privacy easily explains why that is. If we want to get a foothold in understanding the neural correlates of consciousness, we of course have to ask subjects what they're feeling and experiencing, at least initially. We can make enough progress that this becomes less and less necessary, but they're always the final authority. If the neuroscientist says they're seeing a green frog, but the subject denies any such appearance, then all else equal, we would side with the subject, not the neuroscientist. Why else would that be, other than the fact that the subject stands in a privileged relation to their own experiences. And if that's not the case, why would we need their verification or confirmation at any point? If their conscious experiences were as publicly observable as their neurological events, they could have remained in perpetual silence as neuroscientists carried on their work on the neural correlates of conscious experience. And in ordinary life, too, we don't often know what others are thinking and feeling, and vice versa. I've noticed a lot of illusionists, actually I think almost every single one I know, has really loved making a point about how sometimes others can tell what you're feeling before you attend to your own feelings, which is true. Once I remember at work being told to take a walk since I was obviously about to lose my temper. I thought I was fine, so I said no, but about a minute later I realized that my coworker was right and that I should take a lap. She knew before I did that I was too angry and needed to walk away for a second. Okay, that's interesting. But I think I'm not just a mind, I'm also a physical body, which is closely conjoined with my mind. There are different ideas about how that works exactly, but I'm an embodied conscious person. And thanks to the physical world, other minds, such as yourself, can have a pretty good idea of what's going on in my mind. It's true that other people occasionally attend to physical indicators of my feelings and experiences before I attend to my feelings and experiences themselves, meaning they know what I'm feeling even before I'm fully aware that I'm having those feelings. Even so, they have to work from indicators of my feelings, not the feelings themselves. Certain physical behavior is reliably correlated with certain experiences, so this can be easy for an attentive observer. It's because of the intricate correlation between the mind and the body that this is possible. So that's how I would explain it. No one denies that there is an intimate correlation between the mind and the body. So how is this a problem for my view? It's not difficult for the non-illusionist to account for at all, so I don't know why this is brought up so frequently and with such enthusiasm. And I find this is generally the case when illusionists or privacy skeptics try to make arguments against privacy. It's just usually not that hard to account for what they're talking about, so I don't know why they bring it up. So as for those bullet points, some of those examples I just ran through are very similar, obviously. They're all variations on a theme, let's say. I am not trying to double count the evidence. I'm giving different examples because different examples will land with different people. Maybe they have a hang up for one of them, but it doesn't apply to the other. So there's a lot of overlap, but these are the kind of phenomena that make me a lot more confident that privacy is real. It's the best explanation of a number of facts about our world. It's not like it all comes down to the conceivability of zombies or something. There have been numerous historical and contemporary examples of overconfidence about where sentience supposedly doesn't exist. And as Jonathan Birch rightly points out, this overconfidence about sentience can be extremely dangerous, as in the case of coma patients, newborns, and animals. Privacy is the best explanation of how anyone ended up in those situations in the first place. How would you explain it otherwise? So, as I said earlier, it is not my goal to misrepresent illusionists or anyone else who rejects the privacy of consciousness, so if I am misunderstanding your rejection of privacy, then treat this as an opportunity to clarify what the hell you're talking about. Like, I want to be charitable, but on the other hand, it does just kind of feel like a slippery move. It seems like it's the go-to move. When someone makes an argument against your view, you just say, "That's not what I meant." Well, I know that I'm coming into contact with some people's views. Like, I don't know how else to understand, for example, what George Ray said. And of course, illusionists don't all believe the same thing. I even know some non-physicalists who doubt privacy. I mean, it's, if I had to guess, it's probably 99% physicalists or physicalist adjacent people. But if I'm not actually attacking your view, then that means that you can accept my arguments and say, consciousness does have the feature that you're talking about, that you're labeling privacy. But when I say I reject privacy, I just mean, I don't know, I can know what other people are feeling. Okay, well, that was never in doubt. No one was ever questioning that. I can have knowledge of other minds. I can have knowledge of what other people are experiencing. I have not been arguing for solipsism or radical skepticism this whole time. So if you say that I'm not really coming into contact with your views on the subject, then I hope that is your good faith representation of your views, because I have to confess, I am often left wondering if I can actually take this group of people at their word, whether they actually mean what they're saying. Like, one example of this is that Dan Dennett has a paper entitled On the Absence of Phenomenology. I mean, obviously, he doesn't mean what the title makes it sound like he means. Anyway, I've been trying to give some arguments. I've been trying to find some common ground. Now, I think the privacy of consciousness is perfectly freaking obvious, but the wonderful thing about philosophy is that we can question obvious-seeming truths. We can dig down to the foundations of reality until our spades are turned. We can actually question everything. So I want to thank illusionists and privacy skeptics in general for daring to question the obvious and for being puzzled by what seems natural to most of us. I think they're wrong in this case. Although if you look, you'll find that illusionists do say true and interesting things about consciousness. Being puzzled by the things that most of us take for granted can uncover hidden gems. So be nice to your friendly neighborhood illusionist, but never, under any circumstances, tolerate the presence of a panpsychist. They need to be ostracized, and this will strike some listeners as harsh, but I have in the past advocated the death penalty for panpsychists, and I stand by that today. Oh, including me? Yes, especially me. Shoot me with a crossbow, when I least expect it. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green. My address is in the show notes, and I will see you soon.